Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Adam Nicholson. He is the author of many books on history, landscape, and great literature, but tonight we're talking about his latest one, Life Between the Tides. Adam, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book. We were talking off mic, and I have to read a lot of books. I read on the average 3 to 4 books a week, and I read them thoroughly. And so as a reader, you know, most books are just what you thought that they were going to be. I love it as a reader when the book sort of explodes in your brain and goes into a lot of different places, and that's what this book does. And I just want to thank you for a great reading experience.
Well, it's, of course, you know, there's nothing that a writer would like to hear more than that. I mean, that's fantastic. It was quite an adventure doing it.
I can imagine.
It led me down paths I wasn't entirely expecting. But I also knew I didn't want it to be absolutely shut into another book about poking around in tidal pools, you know, because there are plenty of them around.
Yeah, but, you know, I thought, well, it'll be a good book about tide pools, and then I had no idea. The great thing was going into this unsuspecting and then following you down every rabbit hole and then having you tie it together. So let's talk about this. You start, the book starts ostensibly, and this is wild. You decide to construct tide pools. Now, it ends up being 3. And tell me where you decided to construct these tide pools.
Okay, so my wife's family has a place on the west coast of Scotland, a very wild, remote place. Mountains coming down to the sea, savage winters, huge tide streams running past. And they have this lovely little house, 19th century house, at the head of a bay, a big bay, and which has big cliffs and waterfalls behind it, wonderful medieval castle, a lighthouse, like a sort of almost a toy image of what the west coast of Scotland might be like. And there's a beautiful black basalt sand beach at the head of the bay. And otherwise, it's a really rocky, rubbly, volcanic boulders. And it's a kind of geology that doesn't make tide pools. And I'd always been entranced by the idea of tide pools. And so I thought the one thing that this place does not have, I mean, it has so much else, white-tailed sea eagles, dolphins, incredible fish. I mean, it's absolutely brimming and bursting with life. But the one thing it doesn't have is tide pools, so why not make them? And a bit of an eccentric thing to do, I get that word. I take the accusation. But this was COVID lockdown.
Okay.
And so, you know, you're stuck and shut and still. And so the only thing to do is, obviously, I and millions of others across the world, tens of millions probably, really attended to our local realities.
That's right.
And I think in a way that's what this book is about.
Well, first of all, one of the things is you're fascinated by that intertidal zone there, the thing where the ocean meets the shore. It's a very violent habitat. It's a very confusing habitat. Yet there's all this life that lives there.
Yes, I mean it's one of the great revelatory places, I think, on Earth, where if you every day, I think the tidal fall, rise and fall in that bay is something like 16 feet every day, and that's vertical, and the horizontal extent is several hundred yards, and so every day, twice a day, you have this other world, this other planet revealed to you. Well, you know, if that isn't an invitation to a writer, I don't know what is. You know, have me. Oh no, you can't have me. I'm yours. No, I'm not. I'm walkable. Oh no, I'm not. You could be drowned here. No, you could sunbathe here. You know, and there's this kind of, I called the book Life Between the Tides because it is about life in the intertidal zone, the great revelatory zone, which is half sea, half land. But it is also how all of life exists in a tidal condition,
Yes, yes.
You know, we are all in the flux. And actually accommodating flux, learning to cope with variation, to thrive in variation, is in a way the kind of central challenge of life. And so that's, as you know, you began by saying how this book wandered off down paths. Well, it damn well did. But the reason it did is that this condition, the tidal condition, is so fundamental to the phrase we're always kind of frightened of using, but it's fundamental to the meaning of life.
Yeah.
That's really what it ended up being about as well.
Well, you're focusing down. You're building these tide pools and watching life as it starts to go into and live in your tide pools. So you're actually mapping it too. You're creating these maps that are in the book. But as you focus down, like say on the sandhoppers or the urchins or the anemones, what happens is the more you focus down, the more there seems to be to know.
Yes.
And the more it sort of recedes from your grasping.
Yes. It's the great kind of Socratic thing that the more you look, the more ignorant you become. And it's, you know, that is not what is accepted in most educational establishments, but it is true. And it's to do with the fractal notion of
That's
reality,
right.
You know, that actually, you know, the first person who wrote about fractals was this French-American Benoit Mandelbrot in the 60s, 1960s. And the article, I think it was in Nature or one of the great science magazines, was entitled, How Long is the Coast of Great Britain? And the coast of Great Britain gets longer as you reduce the size of the ruler you use to measure it. So if you had a ruler 100 miles long, the coast of Great Britain, I think, would be something like 3,000 miles. But obviously, as you come down to a ruler a foot long, 6 inches, an inch long, to a microscopic subatomic level, actually the length of the coast of Great Britain stretches towards infinity.
It's like Zeno's paradox.
It what?
It's like Zeno's paradox.
Zeno's paradox, it is. And so if you make a tide pool, which in the first one was only about kind of 6 feet across, they got a bit bigger, about 30 feet across, but I thought, great, tide pool. I'm going to be able to have within the compass of this little pool the totally intelligible. But of course, tide pools have bays. And bays have bays, and bays have bays, and on it goes until you end up. Well, I ended up in a sort of marvelous state of amazement. Really, I think it's Plato who says the beginnings of philosophy, the beginnings of understanding, are a state of amazement, and that too, I think, is what this is about. Just you can't, in a way, it's connected to the great crisis, the great biodiversity crisis.
That That's right.
You obviously can't do anything about the destruction of life on Earth unless you know about it. You can't know about it unless you look at it, and you can't really look at it unless you spend inordinate amounts of time poking about in tide pools. You know, that is another sort of hidden purpose of this book, that you can only do anything useful if you know, and you can only know if you're aware. And so it's just a kind of great, it's really a kind of act of self-education, I think.
There's a great quote from you in this book that really hit home to me. A fragmentary illumination of the layers of understanding, skill, and volition in the most unconsidered corners of life.
Absolutely, you know that I eat prawn sandwiches along with the best of them, you know. But if you actually spend time with a prawn, there's a marvelous man, a Frenchman, in Bordeaux, a professor in Bordeaux called Pascal Fossin, and he caught a whole load of, in fact, they were crayfish. They were American crayfish that had escaped into the marshes near Bordeaux, but they're very close relation to prawns. And he took three sets of these. He looked after them all very carefully, so they were entirely calm for quite a long time, for a couple of months, in his laboratory. And one set he just left in that lovely, calmed condition. The second set he gave a mild electric shock to. And the third set he gave a mild electric shock and then a dose of an anti-anxiety drug, benzodiazepine. So he then took these three categories of crayfish and put them in a maze, underwater maze, of which some arms were dark and some were light. And the ones that were in the crayfish that were calm wandered wherever they felt like within the maze. They were very kind of interested to see what was going on in all different corners of it. The ones he had given an electric shock, mild electric shock to, were clearly anxious, and they hid in the dark arms of the maze and wouldn't go out into the light. And the third category, that had been shocked and then been given the anti-anxiety drug, they behaved exactly as the first category had, exploring everywhere. So what does one conclude?
That's right. I mean, this is what your book, this is the essence of your book, is once you read the research of a person like that, or the writings of a person, there's 100 other questions.
Yes, but I mean, the key thing about this was that
prawns are feeling things.
Prawns that wouldn't go anywhere. Well, those crayfish wouldn't go anywhere. Were frightened of what might happen to them. So in other words, those animals, which are separated from us by 700 million years of evolution, a long, long gap, and they clearly could imagine that something bad would happen to them. In other words, there was no present fear. They weren't terrified by what was there in front of them. They thought maybe there was something there. So they could remember the electric shock. They could fear a possibly dangerous future. In other words, crayfish and prawns, all of these crustaceans, can actually have an imagination. Wow.
I know.
That's extraordinary.
Well, I was amazed by that. I was amazed by limpets, which people don't even give a thought to.
This is obviously the big problem with what's going on in the world. We don't actually give a thought to any of these animals. So people have said to me, well, so that means you're going completely vegetarian, are you now, Adam? And I said, no, I am not. And why am I not? Because there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that if the scales were changed and a prawn was offered a man sandwich, it wouldn't hesitate in eating the man sandwich. So I think this is a perfectly kind of sane relationship to a prawn, to be amazed by its mental capacities and to be perfectly happy to put it in some mayonnaise and bread.
And you also, in the course of the book, you also had a great drink. The plankton shot.
Sure. I did, because I wanted to find out if in the bay I could find some of the plankton. You know, in the warmth of summer, that there's a plankton bloom, and so I got a plankton net and trawled it behind my boat up and down the bay for a while. And at the foot of the net, at the tail end of the net, there's a little bottle which you can detach. And so I then poured this water from the plankton net into a petri dish under a microscope and had a look, and I didn't have any high expectations, but I don't know if you've ever done this, Mark, have you? But
oh yeah, I've been on ships where they've done it.
It's incredible.
It is. It's pretty quite. It's pretty crazy.
In the title of the book in England was, in fact, "The Sea Is Not Made of Water." As a result of that experience, that the sheer multifarious diversity and the kind of bubbling vitality of the life that one is simply unaware of. You think, that's just a piece of water for me to go water skiing over. It is actually as complex an environment as anywhere on Earth. Anyway, so I had a wonderful afternoon looking at these little creatures zipping to and fro. But then I wanted to photograph them, and they wouldn't stay still. So I knew something had to be done, and I suppose one should really put industrial alcohol or something in, but I didn't have any. So I tipped a little shot glass of Finnish vodka into the Petri dish. It's very satisfactory. Photographed the planktonic crabs and other animals, but then thought, really, I owed it to them not to throw it all away. So I obviously drank the vodka with the plankton. The plankton shot. I mean, I can see, I don't know. I suddenly thought, oh my God, maybe that's poisonous.
No.
But anyway, I'm still going strong now.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Adam Nicholson. He's the author of many books on history, landscape, and great literature. And tonight, we're talking about Life Between the Tides, a sort of deceptive book. And it is about one thing, but it's about a lot of other stuff, too. One of the spirits of the book, one of the central figures of the book, is Heraclitus. Can you talk about why Heraclitus is important?
Yes, so Heraclitus is this early philosopher. He lived in what is now Western Turkey in Ephesus in about 600 BC. And a fantastic, strange writer. Very, very opaque, difficult to know exactly what he means. But one of the central things about one of his central statements is famously, you can never step into the same river twice, because everything, the river, and by implication, everything is flowing. Everything flows. And so nothing maintains its identity. That actually, there is a sort of materialist conception of the world that things are the things that they are, and that is what they are. But Heraclitus sort of puts the skids under that, I think, really, and says, actually, things aren't what they are. They're merely just moments in a kind of fluent condition, that life streams through these forms, that actually life needs to take in resources and obviously excretes byproducts, gases or whatever, and the form that life takes is really the form of a wave. That it's just as a wave travels through a body of water, and that the wave is not actually the molecules that it shifts, but it is the form. And this Heraclitean idea that substance is not substance, but actually being is process, being is things in things happening, is, I think, absolutely central to any understanding of the tidal world and in fact to the world as a whole. And he has this wonderful statement that opposites connect. Opposites are in some ways the same. And that the identity of anything depends on the tension of opposing forces. And so his model for that is the bow and the lyre. That only because the string of a bow is pulling in the opposite direction to the arms of the bow, because those two forces are in tension, does the bow actually have a kind of coherent existence. And if the string is over-tightened, or the strength of the arms of the bow is not sufficient, the bow breaks, and the wholeness of that thing disappears. And so it's an intriguing idea that coherence is contained opposition. His brilliant, concise distillation of that is to say that strife is justice.
Huh.
Eris eni dikia in Greek. So that only if things are actually set against each other will you have a kind of coherent, just world. And tyranny or pollution, you could even say, is the result of things no longer being in tension with each other. Well, that if you have a tyranny, it just completely swamps the vitality of everything else. Or even a pollution incident, You know, if you just dump oil all over a shore, then the sheer fact of the oil has removed all those tense competitive relationships which make it a coherent ecology.
You have several examples in the book. I think about Bob Payne and his research on the purple sea star, about how interconnected everything is.
Yes, well, Bob Payne, the great Washington State biologist who died relatively recently, discovered that the presence of these very dominant sea stars actually guaranteed the multiplicity of life in the trophic levels beneath it. And so he removed sea stars from a stretch of the coast in Washington. And as he removed them, then the mussels, I think very potent California mussels, began to take over. And all kinds of species of chitons and barnacles and anemones disappeared from the environment there, because the sea star had controlled the kind of layers beneath them and allowed a multiplicity to happen. And so he coined the term keystone species for that it's like the keystone of the arch. Remove the keystone and all these stones in the arch beneath it start to tumble down in these, what he also coined this phrase, these trophic cascades. You just get these terrible ripple effects down through ecologies. And so I think this, it's absolutely mysterious to me that a philosopher in, the 6th century BC could actually have clocked a discovery made in the 1960s and 70s by a great American biologist. Isn't that just, it's just a magical connection of the two ends of human culture, I think.
It's pretty amazing. It is amazing. And it's, by the way, it also shows the importance of why a classical education is still important.
I guess so. Not that I had one. I don't think you actually need one. I think all I was taught Greek. I hated it when I was a boy, but as a late middle-aged man, I've really got stuck into it. I'm writing a book about those early Greek philosophers now, and you can learn. You can keep learning.
That's right. Now the book expands. It expands to sort of beyond the Earth, because we talk about the moon and tides, and then it becomes interior too, because it's not just the tides in the cosmology, how they work and how what happens, but it's how humans and societies thought about tides. And that becomes very interesting. I love the thought about tides and reality and the imagination. There were things that you mentioned in the book, that the best butter was churned when the tide had just paused at low slack water. There was something weird about that pause at slack water that captured people's imaginations.
I think that, inevitably, if you spend time beside a tidal sea, you come to feel the reality of it. And it is obviously a cosmic reality. That the only reason that the Earth is spinning is that it's kind of formed out of this spinning dust of a cloud of dust in the making of the solar system. So, it is... Someone said about the only time, when you see a tide rising, it's the only time you ever see anything falling up.
Huh.
That's disturbing, isn't
it? It is disturbing.
but true, the other thrilling thing, everyone knows, of course, that the tides now, post-Newton, that the tides are governed by the moon. But of course, so the moon creates this bulge of water on its side of the Earth. But in fact, the only reason that the tide goes up and down is because the Earth, the rocky Earth, revolves inside that envelope of water which has been pulled out by the moon. And so when you see a kind of big tidal flow running past a headland, we actually assume that it is the water moving. But from the point of view of an observer in space, it is actually the Earth, that headland, that is driving through the water, that is remaining still in space, if that makes sense to you.
It does. It does.
You look at a buoy, sort of moored buoy out in the middle of a tidal channel, and water is streaming past it. But in fact, the water isn't streaming past it. The buoy is being dragged through that water. I think that's just so beautifully revelatory about, that we need to understand the cosmic situation as much as these microscopic planktonic things, and that only if you get that whole scale of vision can you hope to sort of really understand the condition that we are necessarily living in. It's that great breadth of scale that leads to understanding.
We're completely out of time. I want to end. In the end of your book, you talk about the core of being is interplay, and it gives and take of quick and still is the animation of life.
Yeah, that is right. That I think that any kind of singular, that like we were saying about Heraclitus, any singular assertion of a dominant reality, and there are clearly kind of political dimensions to this idea. On social dimensions, psychological, physical dimensions. It works on every level, that only by mutual accommodation, even if it's a tense one, can you hope for goodness.
My returning guest tonight has been Adam Nicholson. He is the author of many books on history, landscape, and great literature, but tonight we've been talking about a fantastic read. His latest book, Life Between the Tides. Adam, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.